fundrive.ca or text donate to 778-782-2573 now to make your donation to Fundrive 2024.
On September 12, 2024, the Biden-Harris administration celebrated 30 years since the passage of the U.S. Violence Against Women Act, with an announcement of new funds and new areas of coverage. Although passed in 1994, the bill was first introduced in 1990. From the Wings Archive 1991, here is longtime Washington reporter Sarah McClendon interviewing the senator who drafted and co-introduced that act and would shepherd it through. Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. In the 95% male U.S. Congress, bills seeking to benefit women are slow to pass. Take the Violence Against Women Act. First introduced in 1990, it has little overt opposition. Even well-known masculinists in the Senate Judiciary Committee twice gave it unanimous approval, though some voiced doubts it would be effective. The bill currently has 51% of the Senate as co-sponsors. If they all stick with it, that's a one-vote majority. Senator Hatch of Utah commented that it's very hard to oppose a bill with such a name. But in the lower house of Congress, the House of Representatives, bills can be quietly stalled to death in a maze of committees. The House Judiciary Committee, for example, has held the Violence Against Women Act for a year without referring it to subcommittees. According to Washington reporter Sarah McClendon, the Judiciary Committee, chaired by Jack Brooks of Beaumont, Texas, has become the black hole of Calcutta. Bills disappear in there and are never seen again. Pursuing an interest in the Violence Against Women Act, McClendon questioned the author of the bill about its contents and its chances. The senator is best known for his appearances on international television, chairing the Senate Judiciary hearings in which attorney Anita Hill alleged sexual harassment by now Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas.
This is Sarah McClendon in Washington. We're interviewing Senator Biden of Delaware. We are talking to him about violence against women, a bill which he has pending in the Senate. And Barbara Boxer, the woman running for U.S. Senator in California, she is author of the bill in the House. The bill has not been getting very far in either House or Senate for complications. Senator Biden, how did you get interested in putting in a law on violence against women?
Well, Sarah, I've been spending a lot of time as chairman of the Judiciary Committee over the years dealing with the, quote, issue of violence. And I thought violence was the sort of ultimate equal opportunity employer. I thought there was as much violence against young as old and women as men. And then I saw the statistics about 3-4 years ago. I was going over the FBI statistics, and a startling thing literally leapt out at me, and this is not an exaggeration. Violence acts against young men between the ages of 18 and 25 decreased by about 12% over a 15-year period. And during that same period of time, violence against young women in that age category increased by over 50%. And it was from 1974 to 1987. And so you had an actual decrease of 12% in the violence against young men, and you had an increase of over 50% in violence against women.
Well, do you think this is because women asserted themselves so much and became publicly known as feminists, or why?
Well, I'm not sure why. We had a number of hearings with a number of leading women psychologists and psychiatrists. Some suggest that that was part of the reason. I think the biggest part was because of the drug epidemic that started, and women became easier targets than men, in that if you have a chance or an opportunity to go out and, commit a violent act against a woman who weighs 110 pounds or a man who weighs 225 pounds, the tendency is to go after someone who is not as big.
Do you think it's because in our society we never did train these young men coming up to respect women more?
Well, I think that's true. One of the women who testified before my committee asked me the following question one day. I said, Senator, do you know where the term rule of thumb comes from? And I said, well, I assume it's a measurement of some sort. She said, well, it is, but let me tell you what it is. She said back in the 13th or 14th century in England, where women were viewed as chattels, the personal property of their husbands or daughters of their fathers, that a man was allowed to beat his wife. And even in England, it was concluded that the beatings had gone too far. So they put in the common law the following rule, that a man could beat his wife with a switch or a stick as long as it was not bigger than the circumference of his thumb.
Oh, my gosh.
And the problem is we've never faced the fact that in this country, we've never fundamentally gotten away from the notion that it is our woman or my wife as if it were property. Mm-hmm. That still underlies, in my view, much of this notion about what is appropriate and what is inappropriate.
Listen, I think your bill is really unusual. It's amazing. It's quite taking off from something the old style. You're trying to change the procedure in the United States courts.
That's exactly right. What I'm trying to do is allow women to have a civil rights cause of action. That is, not only do we increase the criminal penalties for violence against women, but if a woman is a victim of a crime merely because she is a woman, just as if a black or Hispanic or anyone else, a minority, is a victim of a crime merely because of their race, then a special cause of action arises, civil cause of action, in the federal courts. And that is, and allows that person to collect damages in addition to the criminal penalty. And so I created a category allowing crimes which were directed against women solely because of their sex, if that they have to prove that it's solely because of their sex, that they have a civil rights cause of action allowing them to collect money as well against their the person who victimizes them. For example, rape is up phenomenally high.
Yes.
Well, rapists aren't all people crouching in alleys that are poor and criminals. They are doctors and lawyers and Indian chiefs, figuratively speaking.
You're right. You're right.
And they should be able to be gone after for their purse as well as what they own as much as putting them in jail as well.
Well, this civil rights concept is getting some opposition from a well-known man, Chief Justice William Rehnquist, I understand.
Well, it has, and it's really disappointed me. The Chief Justice almost gratuitously has suggested that if the Biden bill were to pass, the Violence Against Women Act were to pass, it would have the effect of clogging up the federal courts. And he went on to say something I hope he didn't mean. I hope it just was a slip of the tongue. He said because women would use the allegation of physical violence against them in order to negotiate better divorce settlements. And so he made the case that it would be used by women to threaten to pull a man or husband or a boyfriend into federal court if they didn't settle with them in a more reasonable way from their perspective in divorce settlements and property settlements.
I wish we could get this man turned around, but in case we don't, you've got something in here that's very unique. You want to educate rapists after they get in prison, I understand.
That's right, and I want to educate young men on campuses before rapes occur as well. There's two pieces of this. Part of what we find out is, there was another, if you excuse the reference, there was a poll that took place in 1987 in the state of Rhode Island, a very well-respected poll, and it asked children in grades 7, 8, and 9 in the state of Rhode Island, statistically accurate poll, if a man spends $10 on a woman on a date, and then she refuses to have sex with him, does he have the right to force sex on her because he spent $10? And an astounding answer came back. Close to one quarter of all the young men, almost a third of all the young men, 7th, 8th, and 9th grade in the state of Rhode Island, answered yes to that question. And close to one-fifth, actually more than one-fifth, over 20% of the young girls said, yes, if a man spends $10 on me, he has a right to force sex on me. So there's something fundamentally wrong in this country with regard to how we view a man's, quote, rights relative to sexual activity with a woman. And it goes beyond even that. Therefore, what we did is we did two things in this legislation. We, number one, we established that in each of the on each of the college campuses in America. There has to be a clear delineation, if they get federal funds, a clear delineation at the beginning of the freshman year of every for every man. They have to sit through an orientation period with a clear definition of what constitutes what they are allowed to do and not allowed to do. Basically, being told you have no right under any circumstances to put your hand on a woman, regardless of how provocative she may be. It does not allow you to do that.
That's wonderful. Well, how in the world are you going to carry out this provision to educate judges?
Well,
I've heard a lot of nasty comments from judges in sentencing women in some of these cases.
Well, so have I. And interestingly enough, some of the most progressive men who were judges, as well as women judges, came before us and said, hey, look, the problem with a lot of these judges is that they have not been sensitized to the circumstances women find themselves in. And they have to be more sensitized to it. So we require that there literally be education for judges on the circumstances surrounding the difficulties women have with regard to violence generally. Just as I drafted several years ago a bill that did become law involving abused children. One of the things we found out from judges, not us, judges told us this, that they had to be better educated judges as to how to treat children in a courtroom, to say to them to not demand the same exact things, conversely, as they do of adults. Women are clearly not children, but their circumstance is fundamentally different than men, when it, particularly a male judge, when it comes to understanding that, as one judge in Florida overturned a rape conviction because the woman was wearing a miniskirt that was too high and was revealing. Well, that's outrageous, absolutely, totally outrageous. No woman, no matter what she wears, is saying, you're allowed to rape me, you're allowed to abuse me. And so judges have to understand there's a direct correlation between a man's obligation and the law, not a man's obligation and a woman's dress.
Yes.
And they have to be educated to that.
Well, you have a provision in here that I think is good. I remember this picture show I saw recently about the green sliced tomatoes.
Yeah.
You have a provision here about if a lady has a warrant against a man not to bother her in one case, one state,
while it
goes over to another state?
It's so hard now. Women die. Right now, a woman as we speak is probably being murdered by a husband or a lover who has been harassing her for some time. And what happens is that women fight like the devil to go into courts in their states to get what they call stay-away orders, to get the court to say, John Doe, you cannot go within 1/2 mile of this woman. You must stop harassing her or you'll be arrested. But the problem is, when that woman, if she's a businesswoman, when she's sent by her company across the state line from Virginia into Maryland, that order doesn't prevail. That man can go into Maryland or Virginia, whichever way she's going, and harass her there. I want to federalize those orders. I want, if a woman gets a legitimate stay-away order in one state, that automatically would be able to be upheld and would, in fact, be the law in all states. Because women are not captives of individual states. They're business women. They have to travel. And they should not have to go into 50 different states to get 50 different courts to say, this man is harassing me.
This bill would give women a lot of the protection that they would have had if we'd had the Equal Rights for Men for Women Amendment to the Constitution.
Well, yes, because it's born out of the same notion.
Yes.
It's born out of the same fundamental principle that it's time for this country to face squarely the fact that women are not given the same status and standing as men. We can pass all these bills we want. I'm very proud of this act. But if it passes tomorrow, Sarah, it is not going to fundamentally change women's position in society. What has to change is we have to change the way we view women literally as equals in our society.
On Wings from our archive, 1991. This is 81-year-old Washington reporter Sarah McClendon interviewing 49-year-old Senator Joe Biden about the Violence Against Women Act he drafted and introduced in the Senate, while Representative from California Barbara Boxer drafted and introduced the Violence Against Women Act in the House.
One of the things this legislation does, it has a number of parts. For example, there's a safe streets portion where we give more money to prosecute attackers. We target the most dangerous areas in America to provide extra lighting and extra police.
Will that include where prostitutes walk in these cities?
Sure. And by the way, this is going to be very controversial. You'll probably get letters and so will I in this. Whether or not a woman is a prostitute doesn't mean a man has a right to rape her.
Absolutely.
Doesn't mean a man has a right to abuse her.
He doesn't have a right to as a husband either.
That's exactly right. I remember there was a senator who I will not mention now, but Birch Bayh and I drafted legislation years ago saying that a man could be held guilty of raping his wife.
Yes.
And we were marking that bill up, you know, that parlance in this place, marking up. We were putting the final dots on it and periods and crossing the T's. And one senator, who's no longer here, was very angry that we were doing this. And he said, you just don't understand. Sometimes a husband has to use force. That is a bizarre, outdated notion, but one that a very small minority of men seem to still cling to, and one we have to root out.
Yeah.
And part of what this legislation does is to make the home safer and the streets safer, but also in the campuses, but to state very clearly that this society thinks that the civil treatment of women is one of the highest priorities. They're entitled to equal treatment. Equal treatment does not occur now because they are victimized much more than men are.
Very true. I was astounded at how much money you were trying to get for safe homes. I understand. Is that money about to run out?
Well, it is. I think we can get this money. What we're talking about is a fair amount of money here that is designed primarily to provide for not just safe homes, but streets as well as campuses. And it's about $500 million, $500 million. Mm-hmm. Now, we're able to go out and spend tens of billions of dollars in other ways. But when we talk about, for example, you've been a professional woman your whole life. You are very accustomed to what a lot of people haven't been except for the last 15 years. You've been sent out after writing a story late at night back at your desk and having to go at 2 o'clock in the morning to the parking garage to get your car. That's not new to you.
Yeah.
But as more and more women came into the workplace over the last 20 years, they found themselves more and more in circumstances that made them vulnerable than before. So, for example, you see women at 11 o'clock at night at bus stops now. You see women at 12 o'clock at night, professional women going into parking garages because they're lawyers or doctors or journalists working late. And so what we do is we provide cities and towns money to do things literal, things that work. Put better lighting at bus stops. Put better lighting in areas where women are required to be because of the change of the economic circumstances. We also require colleges to pay much more vigilance to the security of women on campus than they do now. So it's not an afterthought, mm-hmm. it's a forethought. And we also provide for, currently, we don't spend any money, as a practical matter, on shelters for battered women. And so there are three times as many shelters as animals as there are for battered women. We authorize $28 million that's there now, and we triple that amount of money for women. Because, you know, for example, we held hearings, Sarah, and we had the leading doctors from the trauma centers in the United States, the emergency rooms, come in and tell us that almost three-quarters of all the women that appear in an emergency room that have some concussion, they're bleeding or bruised, it's a consequence of a beating from a boyfriend or a husband.
Horrible.
And we don't arrest people for that. For example, there's a presumption we change in here. We copied it from the state of Washington. One of the counties in was the state of Washington. If the police are called on the scene, man is present and a woman is bleeding or physically beaten, the presumption is they must arrest that person, whether or not the woman sweared out a warrant, because it's within the police power to do that.
Yes.
Right now, they don't do that. 70% of the time, a woman's bleeding from some orifice and there's no arrest that's made. Yeah. And people say, well, why would that be the case? Well, it's real simple. I say this to guys. I say, you know, they say, well, why wouldn't a woman just swear out that warrant? And I say, think back when you were a kid in school. Were you the big guy in school? No, I was a little. What happened when the bully came up and punched you in the mouth? Even when you had a clear shot of punching him in the nose, what did you do? You refrained from it, didn't you? Well, yeah. Why? would just make a matter. I said, well, what do you expect a woman to do? A woman is going to have to go back into that same house mm-hmm. with that man after she swears out a warrant for him and he's let mm-hmm. out on bail. What do you think she thinks? And so we just have to change. We have to take some of the burden, if you will, off of women mm-hmm. in terms of the Herculean efforts they have to take in order to protect themselves. We've got to give them some kind of
cover. I wish we'd had you around for years, Senator. You're wonderful. Well, tell me this. Have you and Barbara Boxer conferred much about progress on this bill and get it through the Congress?
We have. It's passed through the Senate.
She's out in California.
She's out in California. She has a number of allies that she has put together over in the House side. One of the problems is
you have
know,
51, I believe.
We do. 51 senators. The problem is that those who are opposed to the bill are using the rules very. The Senate rules and the House rules, very particularly the Senate rules, very imaginatively. Once we bring this up, if we brought it up as, to use the parlance, a freestanding piece of legislation, you would find that it would attract every piece of political, every piece of demagoguery that is hanging around out there. There'd be people putting amendments to it that relate to habeas corpus, and people putting amendments to it relating to pornography or dial-a-porn, all of which are important. Executions. There's a lot of ingenious ways to kill this legislation. And so what I'm looking for, as is the House leadership, for a vehicle, for a piece of legislation we can attach this to very bluntly, that makes it impossible to veto it, that makes it impossible to kill it.
Good.
And that's where we are right now. I think we will get this passed, but the biggest impediment we now have is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who's lending some, I think unwittingly, lending credibility to the argument that somehow this is, although it may be needed, this is just going to clog the federal courts. We didn't ask that question when we increased federal jurisdiction to take the swindlers and the SNL scandals into federal court. Everybody
sure,
said, that's
not
a good idea.
Yeah.
We didn't do it when we said the Disability Act for Disabled Americans, which is a good act, which is creating a federal cause of action.
Now, even automobile insurance cases.
And we didn't say anything about that. But as soon as we say women,
yeah.
It's like, oh, wait, no, they may use this. So they may connive and use this to deal with their property settlements.
Yeah.
I think that's simply not fair, and I think we'll prevail on it.
I think Barbara Boxer in the House has a hard time, too. Maybe the Senate has that problem. Too many committees want to share in it.
Well, that's the other problem.
I think half a dozen committees over in the House that want a part of it.
It's one of these things. Here's the ultimate irony, but you and your vast experience understand this better than I do, although I've observed it a lot in 19 years. It suffers from the problem of not made here.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to make this anybody's act. Drop the Biden Violence Against Women. Let's call it the Thurman Violence Against Women Act, or the Smith Violence Against Women, or the Republican Violence. I don't care what we call it. I don't care who gets it. But right now, part of it is it's the irony of being very popular among the American people, who I think sense that something is needed in this area.
Well, women are certainly interested in it.
And on the other hand, because it's popular, there is the desire to not pass it unless it has your name on it, whomever you is. And but I think we'll get around that. We'll just make this the bipartisan violence against. And I mean this sincerely.
Yeah. Do you think that the Smith rape case down in Florida would have been any different if this bill had been in effect?
I don't believe so. I think that one of the things that Florida has a fairly solid, what they call, rape shield law already. So I don't think it would have had any impact one way or another on that. What it would have an impact on are those cases where we prevent a crime from happening in the first place. There's two pieces of this, actually three pieces of this, if you think of it sort of philosophically. One, I think there should be much more done to prevent women from being the victims. And you do that two ways. One, educate young men and young women early on as to what the proper relationship and role is. And number two, make the streets, homes, and campuses physically safer. There's a second piece of this legislation, which is to educate educate people, judges and victims and those who victimize, to their rights and obligations and responsibilities. Judges to their responsibilities, women to their rights, and those who victimize their responsibilities. And the third piece of this is, I have never known of anything that a society says is holds dear, where there is not a severe penalty for violating that thing held. We say we hold dear the protection, the physical security of women in the society. Yet, we reserve for those things we hate the most the title violation of someone's civil rights. We should accord this crime and this activity against women the final bit of disapprobation society can hold out for it. And that is that it violates a woman's civil rights and a cause of action arises from that. And that's the most controversial part of all of this.
Your explanation of what women need and want is far superior to what I've heard in many women and men say heretofore. Are you called on to go out and speak much on this?
I am, but I've been educated a lot by, over the last 6 or 8 years, by some of the leading women lawyers and psychologists and psychiatrists in this country, who have, quite frankly, made me aware of aspects of this that I never thought about before. For example, you find right now that one of the things that happens with so-called date rape or domestic violence is the greatest injury inflicted on a woman tends to be the fact that she blames herself. How many women do you know who have been the victims of violence say things like, well, maybe I shouldn't have gone there. Maybe I shouldn't have worn that skirt. Maybe I shouldn't have said that to him. Women shouldn't have to worry about that. And what I didn't realize is that those who are the victims of date rape and those who are the victims of domestic violence tend to end up being the most psychologically scarred of all.
Yes.
Because the woman who's randomly raped is scarred, God forbid, we know that. But she doesn't usually say, it was my fault. The woman who goes out with a man she trusts who rapes her, or a husband or boyfriend she trusts who violates her physically in any way, she walks away not only physically scarred, but scarred psychologically, saying,
that's right,
it must have been me.
Yeah. Senator, thank you so much. You're really great. This is Senate. We've been hearing from Senator Biden of Delaware, chairman of that famous committee in the Senate, the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Hopefully it'll be less famous.
But, Senator, I think you've got to square yourself away from any of the harm that the Clarence Thomas hearings did by this bill. If you get this bill through, we'll call it even.
Well, thank you, sir.
Good luck to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
From the Wings Archive, 1991, that was longtime Washington reporter Sarah McClendon interviewing Senator Joe Biden about the Violence Against Women Act, which he first introduced in the Senate in 1990. When the act finally passed both houses of Congress in 1994, it carried the name of its former opponent, Representative Jack Brooks of Texas. As of 2024, the Equal Rights Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which Sarah McClendon mentioned, has finally been ratified by the requisite number of states, but long after the number of years that Congress set for completing the ratification. Feminist organizations have been appealing to President Biden to declare it passed and adopted before he leaves office. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. Wing's original sound logo you heard in this program was created by Maggie Payne. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, SVSPO, offers confidential support, advice, and referrals to SFU and FIC community members, including students, staff, and faculty, who have been impacted by sexual violence and misconduct. The SVSPO is a welcoming place where you can access support without judgment or assumptions. We work from a survivor-centered perspective, using an empowerment and trauma-informed approach that considers individual situations and perspectives. Please reach out. Services are located at the Diamond Alumni Center, room 014 on the lower level. Please reach out by email at sv-support@sfu.ca. That was sv-support@sfu.ca.